afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the last panel of today, a very successful Capital Links forum. The panel is called LNG Shipping and the New Energy Landscape. My name is Chris Wernicke. You can see we're going to cover a lot of ground, everything I'm sure from fuels to markets to future directions. And as you can see, we have a powerhouse panel of industry leaders, and they're very recognizable faces to everyone here. And they represent everything from public to private to institutional to oil and gas experience and perspective. Let me introduce the panel, first of all. I've got Captain Abdul Karim Al-Masabi, CEO of ADNOC Logistics and Services. Mr. Evangelos Marinakis, founder and chairman, Capital Maritime and Trading Corporation. Evangelos, congratulations on the great Olympiakos win, by the way. We've got Mr. George Procopio, founder of Dynacom Tankers Management, Dynagas, and Sea Traders. And George, congratulations on the Posidonia Cup win as well. And Mr. Andy Dacey, Managing Director and Group Head, Global Transportation Group of J.P. Morgan Asset Management. And I have Mr. Jeremy Cousins, Senior Vice President, Shipping and Trading, Total Energies. What a panel. Let me go ahead and kind of frame this up, because I think you want to hear, spend most of the time hearing from this really, really prestigious group. But I think this afternoon what we want to do is bring all this collective experience, commercial acumen, and market insights together to talk about LNG, to talk about shipping and the new energy landscape, and in fact, is there a story between the three? And I think this story will be a lot about fuel readiness, about markets, about timelines, and quite frankly, in the case of LNG, about yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So we are in the early innings of a decade of change and uncertainty. You're going to hear that. It's marked by a new language of shipping. It's marked by new global shipping shapers, and it's marked by new boundary conditions: safety, availability, scalability, affordability of fuels and infrastructure. Clearly, what we've heard this afternoon is that short-term energy security and long-term energy transition and geopolitical turbulence are clearly dominating all our conversations. And as we connect the dots together this afternoon, you're going to see how important, I think, LNG has played, both in terms of a fuel and a market, both in terms of yesterday, today, and potentially tomorrow. You know that LNG is the lowest carbon fuel currently available in shipping of scale. It emits about 23% less greenhouse gas emissions compared to very low sulfur fuels. It also does offer a pathway, we've heard this from George actually in the panel before, to get to net zero by incrementally incorporating LNG, bio and LNG, and possibly in the future synthetic LNG. LNG in many ways is a pioneering fuel. It's a good role model fuel. In fact, every new fuel that we are talking about now has to go through what LNG is going through right now. It is a practical transition fuel, and you will hear that it is also a fuel in transition. And it has, in fact, already addressed the three boundary conditions that we talked about: safety, availability, scalability, and infrastructure. And also, LNG has written the story of two great shipping stories. One is Shipping for Shipping, which is a decarbonization of fuel, but the other, more exciting one, is Shipping for the World. As LNG, in fact, you see that market developing, is a market that moves LNG as a cargo. And as we talk about the future of ammonia and hydrogen and moving them essentially as fuels, that's exactly what we have been doing with LNG for the last 15 or 20 years. I just want to mention before we start this up that in today's regulatory environment, a vessel using traditional fuels in combination with energy-efficient designs, has 10 years before it has any rating changes. The same vessel powered by LNG has a 20-year operational life before any rating changes due to CII. So I just wanted to put all that into perspective. And so I also want to say, again, to balance this out, that LNG is not without its challenges. Of course, we know methane slip and the fact that it has carbon content in its core. But in general, as you can see, we have a lot to talk about, so I'm going to go ahead and open the questions to the panel. And I'd like to start with one question to all the panelists to help us frame out the panel perspectives and provide us a reference point for the panel discussions. And the question is, what is your decarbonization strategy? But more importantly, what is your business playbook? Is decarbonization putting your business at risk? What role is LNG playing in both your decarbonization strategy and your overall business strategy? So, Captain, I'm going to go ahead and start with you, and I'm going to just work my way down the road here.
Thank you, Chris. For us, we look at ADNOC and ADNOC Group companies, and the way how we looked at our decarbonization strategy is very unique. And today we look at almost like three mandates that we operate under, which is the ADNOC net zero targets by 2045, but also we have the UA target by 2050. But also as a ship owners and a ship managers and operators, we look at the IMO regulations. So in ADNOC Logistics and Service, we look at the LNG as transition fuel, and as you rightly mentioned, Chris, for us, it's an opportunity, and we look at the order book for the LNG dual fuel on order. There are more than 570 vessels to date, and it keeps increasing. So for us, alternative fuel is going to be definitely an opportunity for us that we see it growing in the future. We've just ordered new ammonia carriers. We've just been in the VLGCs and the LNGs. So definitely we do appraise the opportunity that the LNG is actually posing to us. Secondly, the growing imports. I mean, we're seeing that Asia, for example, will definitely, the newborn volumes is projected to increase by 5%. European seaborne volumes as well is projected to increase by 2% over the period. So all in all, LNG is definitely the reliable, I would say, widely adopted as a transitional fuel. And again, it does meet the criteria for the IMO regulations for the next 20 years. This is how we are looking at it from the ADNOC perspective.
Thank you, Captain. Evangelos?
As far as LNG is concerned, I mean, we paid our decision, and we're going ahead with a number of new buildings, dual fuel vessels with LNG, Aframaxes, LR2s, Suezmaxes, VLCCs, and of course a number of LNG vessels that they are under construction and in the water with the new technology. The reason is we think that for the next 20 years, this is something that LNG has the infrastructure there and has been tested. Of course, it's cleaner. And at the end of the day, we think that as markets will stabilize after the war in Russia and Ukraine, it will be priced very competitively. So at the same time that you take decisions that can help the environment and CO2 emissions, you can take advantage of a lower price, and you can combine both. But I think what is very important to mention is that all this decision and all this risk, we take it ourselves. And because irrespective of all these announcements for the environment and what we need to do in order to improve the conditions and the reduction of emissions, the reality is from the oil majors, with all due respect, that we haven't seen any real appetite to pay a premium for these dual fuel vessels or the vessels that they are more environmental friendly. I think that whoever is cheaper is getting the business. And of course we see that because we see a number of fixtures that have taken place within this year and the year before for deliveries in 2025, 2026 with conventional vessels at very competitive prices. So I think that as far as the oil majors are concerned, a cheap fixture is the what still makes sense. So for us, we take this risk because we feel that we are committed. And of course, in the near future, the market will dictate the premiums. We have enjoyed good markets in the last years, and that makes our investment and our decision more comfortable to pay this premium and take the risk. And I said that, and having said this, I think this is a real commitment from our side, and I hope that for the years to come, these decisions will work out, and not only for the environment, but also economically, that we have made a wise decision.
Great, thank you. George?
Chris, you have touched upon a very, very big topic. And I would like to say that there is a great hypocrisy in the world regarding emissions and the way to go. Since you asked what we are doing, I'll say this, but I want also to put the framework where the world is standing in a very few words. Of course, transportation by ships is the least polluting method, and that's why, and the most efficient, and that's why 80% even more of the global trade, as it was said many times, is with ships. We never, when we speak about alternative means of transportation, we're never thinking about the pollution that is created to build the roads or to make the tires that the transportation, the trucks and so on are using, which is a very heavy pollution. Coming in what we are doing, we are ordering ships that is the best available with the present technology. And never any owner goes to the shipyard to order a vessel with older technology. What is the best available today? And this is 35% at least more efficient in the previous, from the previous models today. And what this means is that for first time, the environmentalist and ship owners' interests are aligned because our biggest expense is fuel. So the most we reduce the fuel, the most we reduce pollution. Pollution is proportionate to the amount of fuel that you burn and the type of fuel. There are alternatives, And LNG is the best, in my opinion. It took 40 years to have the infrastructure and the means to transport it. But it's very good for the LNG carriers, where you have all the other features there. We are a family company, so we try to build environmental friendly ships, but we save $15 to $17 million per ship, plus a huge amount of running costs, because to run a LNG burning vessel, you need different crews from top to bottom. You need LNG type of crews. So LNG is now very much promoted by the United States. It's becoming the, they have ambition to become the first in the world, and they will do, and will be, but, and they say don't buy Russian gas, but they don't add, will give you at the same price. So Europe is buying the gas at energy 5 times more expensive. That's why Germany today is subsidizing the electricity bill of their factories. So there is a lot of hype in all these discussions. And I do believe that the combined diversification on the LNG carriers that are burning the LNG and tankers and bulkers conventional, in my opinion, is the best solution with the new type engines, the Tier 3 with scrubbers. And nobody's willing to pay, as you, my friend Vangeli said, the difference to fit, to foot the bill. So we are not institutions. We are companies that we want to survive, and we buy the best available. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, George. Andy?
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me see if I can say something different than what was said so far. I certainly agree with the comments that have been made. I would say that if we just take a step back, and I think George was alluding to this, shipping definitely gets a bad rap. As was mentioned, it's certainly the most fuel-efficient and emission-efficient way of transporting goods around the world. What we often overlook is the fact that there's other types of industries out there that are certainly polluting a lot more than we are. Livestock industry, for example, represents 17% of global pollution. Certainly road transportation is in that 12 to 13% range. But however, we don't have any voting constituents. We don't represent a nation of any sort. So as a result, we become the punching bag, I would say, of regulators. And I think the big issue when it comes to the decarbonization strategy, and let me talk about that more broadly, is that we as ship owners can do everything that we've talked about. We can go and we can order LNG-powered ships. We can order green methanol-powered ships. We can order ammonia-powered ships. We can order, well, hydrogen is probably still some ways off. But as Chris mentioned, and perhaps the underlying theme of this panel is the safety, availability, and scalability of all these alternative fuels. And I think it's no mystery that these fuels are certainly not available. Some of them are not safe. And the scalability is in significant question. I think, you know, most recently with the development of AI, again, there's no mystery there, but the amount of power that AI consumes as you do an AI search is often 8, 9, 10 times as much power as a traditional Google search. So if you think about the incremental energy requirements that are needed globally, it's not going to shipping. It's not going to be going to, you know, producing alternative fuels. It, unfortunately or fortunately, will be going into the grid to power just typical electricity needs, but also all these incremental AI and technical needs that are developing. And so I think the industry is facing a conundrum where we're being asked to meet all these requirements, which we will do our best to do. And I think a broad-based approach is the way to go. I don't think anybody necessarily has a crystal ball as to what fuel is going to be available and certainly at what price. And I think that makes it difficult to necessarily know which ship is the right ship to order. And I think probably everybody on this panel is certainly taking steps to do test cases. You know, for example, we've ordered green methanol ships. And I have my questions about whether or not that'll be necessarily a pathway that will prove to be successful. And not because the ships themselves won't do what they need to be done, but because the green methanol will be hard to achieve and hard to support and supply into the ships. Ammonia, I think, brings with it its own supply issues. LNG, I think, is good, but as we all know, it's not great. I think it'll definitely be a transitional fuel. It is available. It's mostly safe. So I think as an intermediate step, the industry is going to be on that pathway. But when I think about some of the other scalability aspects, like with ammonia, roughly 175 million tons of ammonia are produced each year globally. About 80% of that goes into the fertilizer business. Another 20% goes into various forms of petrochemical production. There's no incremental ammonia available today for the shipping industry. And if you think about the cost of adding 1 million tons of ammonia production per year, just traditionally, it's about $1 billion of investment to produce an incremental million tons of ammonia. If you're going to produce it in a green way with alternative or renewable fuels, or renewable energy through solar or wind, that is something like $2 to $2.5 billion for incremental ammonia production. So I think there are significant hurdles that are not being driven by us as ship owners, but are being driven by the supply side of the equation. And most energy providers and producers don't wake up in the morning and think about shipping first. They think about how are they going to put energy into the grid. So I think that sets up the challenge. Now, in terms of how you approach that, our approach has been we have dual fuel chemical tankers. We built them and delivered them prior to the pandemic. Sorry, not the pandemic, the war in Russia. As soon as the war in Ukraine and Russia broke out, we didn't burn a single molecule of LNG because the price went so high. So there's all these issues that we have to consider about unknowables in the future that might impact the viability and pricing of alternative fuels. And I think the industry needs to, in some ways, group together to have a dialogue with regulators, because I think some of the goals, while they're great and they're aspirational, I think may be difficult to achieve. And if we don't have that dialogue with regulators to help them understand the implications and the hurdles that are going to be faced as we go down this path, then I think we're going to find ourselves in some really difficult situations when we get to those various milestones, whether in 2030, 2040, or 2050. So I think be conservative in one's approach, certainly invest in the R&D that's needed, but also let's not lose sight of the significant improvements that have been made in traditional fuels. If you look at what take an MR, for example, built in 2008, was burning 30, 31 tons on 12. Today, it's 18, 19 tons on the same speed. That's a significant improvement in just traditional fuel technology. So a mixed approach, I think, put all your chips on various different markers on the board, and then wait to see how the fuel suppliers ultimately develop, because that's the conversation that I think needs to be had.
Speaking of fuel suppliers, Jeremy.
Thank you, Chris. So you ask about what was our playbook in terms of decarbonation. I think TotalEnergies, as a multi-energy company, has embarked quite early on in a energy transition journey, dwelling on two pillars. One is oil and gas, where we think LNG belongs, and the other one is power. So, as Adrian mentioned, we are investing a lot in order to provide all these green electrons that the world is going to need in order to power not only the new application for AI, but also all the road transportation and eventually new molecules, e-molecules. But coming back on the more traditional part of the business, I want to mention that the investment in the LNG production is quite significant, is quite big. For us, the outlook for the size of the LNG market is very, very big and growing, keeps growing. So I think in terms of availability and affordability, we will continue to have a trend where LNG prices should come back to their historical trading range. And we should be able to count on affordability of this fuel. It doesn't solve all our issues, but at least it's providing a short-term incentive to those who have made the investment and the commitment to invest in LNG dual fuel vessels. At TotalEnergies, we have spent quite a bit of resources in order to develop this fleet for big size tankers, VLCCs to Aframaxes, where we believe this is really the best solution today. And we will continue to do it in the coming years. So we need to find the good terms with our colleagues on the ship owner side. When it comes to smaller tanker, we think the LNG unfortunately comes with an extra capex, which is probably too big to absorb. And this is why we have investigated and invested in other fuels, new fuels such as methanol. And we'll see, I share a little bit this concern on where and at what price will we find this green methanol, but still we are willing to take the chance and to pioneer into this new space. On the LNG, really, I think those who have made the commitment today on the VLCC, we think you can enjoy between, I don't know, $8,000 to $10,000 per day discount if you use LNG as a fuel on the correct rate versus a conventional vessel. And we think this is normally a spread that we should continue to see in the coming years and justifying the investment in such new technologies.
Well, great. Thank you. So let me kind of pull some of this together because I think it's quite interesting. I mean, I go back to those boundary conditions that we talked about that really are going to drive kind of any sort of future fuel going forward, which is obviously safety, the unintended consequences of change, availability, scalability of the fuel, and the infrastructure. It's quite interesting because what I'm hearing from the panel is, you know, commercial gravity can't get there alone by the owners because two out of three of these boundary conditions are actually not controlled by the owners in terms of availability, scalability of fuels, as well as infrastructure. And also what I'm hearing very interestingly is this, and I've heard this through the whole day today, I've been here, is that there are kind of two pathways. And we should not discount conventional fuel right now, along with biofuel and potential onboard carbon capture to kind of begin to stretch kind of our timeline before the e-fuels come in. And then, of course, we have LNG and bio-LNG moving forward. And it's very interesting because the new requirements, the fuel EU requirements, actually bring these two together. They have a pooling mechanism in there that says if you have an LNG vessel, you can actually, depending on what type of fuel you use, what type of engine, it can actually cover up to 10 conventional fuel vessels. So you're seeing kind of a story beginning to converge here. I would like to get to Evangelos here and ask you a question because you are very, very active in new buildings, and this includes all sorts of alternative fuel projects. And I just want to ask you, which one of those are you the most excited about relative to their potential going forward? Because you're incredibly active and you see a lot of things, and I just would be really curious to get some insight.
I think that what excites us more is a bit of everything. That's why we have done dual fuel LPGs, dual fuel LNG vessels, and this goes in nearly all sizes, in VLCC, in Suezmax, in Aframaxes, and the same applies as far as the LPG vessels are concerned, from smaller ships, from 22, 40, 45,000 up to 93,000 cubes, but there we have bet on ammonia. So, but let's leave ammonia on the one side right now, and we concentrate on the LNG. So we feel that, as we said, for the next 10 to 20 years, we'll go forward with it. The infrastructure took a long time to be built, and even today bunkering an LNG vessel, it hasn't been as easy as we think, and we see that you have a ship, an LNG bunkering vessel, that will only do two or three or four bunkering operations within a month, which, of course, this has to change and be able to do more, and so it would be cheaper. And but what I'm saying is that all this takes a very long time at a significant expense, and you need to subsidize it for the first years of operation. So if we are to have a serious discussion about other alternative fuels, you can imagine that we are still in very early stage, and it will take a very long time. So answering your questions, I think that we want to be in all sizes. And as I said, I mean, is a premium between, let's say, 15 to 20, 25 million. And if you extend this to container vessels with bigger engines, it can be higher. And we want to be in all market sectors. And as I said, this is a premium that we pay, and the horizon in front is for the next 10, 20 years. So we think that down the line we'll have the chance to capitalize on it.
Great. So, George, I've got to come back and ask you, and you know I think I was going to ask you this question, but playing on the, you know, on that importance of conventional fuels and just being able to run the ships better, because that's quite frankly about, you know, probably about 30-40% of what we can control right now. Is slow steaming the best option today?
It is not today. It was always there. I mentioned that 7 years ago, but that's why I said that is great hypocrisy. If 7 years ago they would say that we reduced the speed for 2 knots, would have saved millions of tons of CO2 emissions over all these years, and our friends from Scandinavia will have a better market for their ships, and they had to have COVID to improve the market. In Cyprus, they wanted to kill me. Why I propose slow steaming. So slow steaming, which now it is with another name because many great egos are around, it is named horsepower reduction. they changed the name. You know, it was very, very odd to use the same name. So it is, and will be always, and you can compensate with the size. Of course, to say that we built 500,000 tons tankers and so on, once upon a time they were, but there is no infrastructure. And as we have seen over the years, the standardization of the various sizes is very important. You cannot change this overnight. So the good solution would be 8 knots with, or 7.5 knots with double size vessels. The ones that were going 15 and were 40,000, you make them 80,000 and so on. But this is easy to say, very difficult to be implemented. So, yes, I insist this is the best and on the ship, the best solution. And on the ships that we are building, we are calculating them with 14.5 knots. So we have a margin of 2 knots, which will make them at least 50% more efficient, maybe 60% more efficient on the previous generation of ships. So yes, this is the remedy. And the sooner we understand and implemented, the better it would be.
Great. Fantastic. Captain Abdul Karim, coming to you and your leadership in ADNOC. You know, ADNOC is on a journey to get to net zero by 2045. And when you look at the calculus to get to net zero by 2045, it's a pretty steep curve. A lot's going on there. Would you be able to give us a little bit of insight and kind of elaborate on what this means on the role of the fleet, and maybe kind of lay out for us what your short game, mid game, and long game is relative to meeting net zero by 2045?
So, as you mentioned, Kasim, it's a very challenging target, 2045, especially within ADNOC Group. I mean, the whole of the UAE is the net zero target is by 2050, but ADNOC have opted to advance this by 5 years. When we look at ADNOC Logistics and Service, I mean, look on the shipping side today, I mean, we own and operate close to 300 vessels. The majority of our emissions do come from the ocean-going fleet, the big vessels, basically. And in order to reduce the emissions, and of course, it's all by embracing new technologies, new alternative fuels, but more importantly, is actually doing the fleet renewal. I mean, in the past 5 years, we've invested more than $5 billion in orders, new orders. But again, it's all about what is the available engines or technologies that is available in the market. So we have opted for all the different type of dual fuel. We have dual fuel LPG vessels, so was in order, delivered, dual fuel LNG vessels, dual fuel VLCCs, and you see, you can always invest, and it comes with a premium. Definitely, the market is actually adopting to these new realities. But again, it's back to George and I think the rest of the panels who just mentioned. I mean, you always opt to take what is best available in the market. No ship owner or operator will go for a substandard new build. So for us, if we looked at from 2020 until today, we've measured that we have already reduced our emissions by 30%. This is already a big achievement that we have done over the past few years. All those vessels that does come with the, like air lubricating system, shaft generators, you name it. It's just like the best available technologies that is available in the market. Reduce steaming or speed is definitely the option for us. But again, it's all about how the stakeholders will come together and try to see what is the new alternative fuel. For us, it's definitely LNG is the widely adopted fuel that we embrace and that we are going for as of now. But if we talk about, for example, the ammonia, we've just landed an order last week for 2+2 ammonia carriers, dual fuel. It could be an ammonia. I was just last week in Copenhagen looking at MAN when they are doing their testing for two-stroke engines of ammonia carriers. That's still some time to go. But this is how we're looking at it and how we will want to go for it. And, definitely, I mean, there is no such magic solution, I would say, today to completely transform the industry overnight, apart from slow steaming, available of dual fuel of LNG, which is widely already accepted and adopted. LPG, yes, we are doing it today. I mean, in our LPG vessels, dual LPG vessels, but that's it. I mean, how much you can do if the stakeholders are not there to help and support. So this is how we are looking at it, guys.
Great. Thank you, Captain. Picking up on the comment on the premium, Andy, since you're a banker by background, I'll ask you a question. Who should pay the green premium? And is sufficient green financing available to pay for shipping's energy transition, or we still be reliant on traditional models going forward?
Who should pay for it? Well, I think we all should pay for it, unfortunately. But if we all pay for it, then we're all paying a very small amount. And I don't think it's unreasonable to expect, and I'm really talking about the consumer. And as we all know, shipping is such a small percentage of the ultimate cost of whatever product or commodity is being delivered that the impact to the consumer shouldn't be that dramatic. But that requires that the end user that ultimately moves the cargo has to have that willingness to pass those costs on. So
And in terms of green financing, I mean, I do think that there are many banks that are ultimately providing some discount to premiums in terms of margins over the base rate. But I think those of you that have borrowed for green financing, those margin discounts aren't that dramatic. And while that may be a slight incentive, I do think that the social good is perhaps the more important incentive in the long run. And look, I think stepping back, just thinking about shipping over the next 10 to 15 years, one could argue, despite the fact that we have these challenges, that we are moving into a golden era, albeit underpinned by difficult, dark things in the industry, right? So everything from geopolitics, shipyard capacity, potential tensions between the East and West, the need for the West to figure out how they're going to supply themselves with ships if tensions happen to increase between the West and China, where now over half of all ships are built and owned. That will ultimately, and if we slow steam as well, then all of this is consuming lots of capacity. And as more and more new ships are built at high prices, hopefully ships that do have some of these future components to them in terms of emission reductions, then the average age or the average price of the overall fleet is going to generally drift upward, which is going to require the charter rate market to stay elevated as that increased cost is ultimately integrated into the overall average fleet. So even though these are difficult issues, I do think shipping has, oddly, a bright future to it. And this is central. The whole transition in fuel is central to that as well. So I think the money will be found. And just an interesting anecdote, for whatever it's worth, ESG, going back over the last 7-8 years, has been a big component of what we've all been talking about. But what you're finding, especially, and I won't say what part of the world, but increasingly, and it's a small percentage, investors are actually saying, and I received a letter not so long ago, where the investor said, if you have ESG as a central component of your decision-making, then we want our money back. Take that for what it's worth, but that is out there as well.
Great. Thanks, Andy. Jeremy, question for you. Is the shipping industry running ahead of the fuel producers? And more specifically, tell us a little bit about the exciting stuff that you're doing with bio-LNG and the potential of bio-LNG to replace conventional LNG.
Yeah. I would add to what has been said at this panel that for me what is key in moving forward in the future is to retain some fuel optionality for the vessels that you will have. So you have a natural fuel optionality with blending some biofuels, conventional biofuels, but if you can afford to have another optionality with LNG or with methanol, we think it's, in the long run, it's going to be extremely valuable because, as you say, probably the shipping industry is a bit ahead of the fuel producers. So retaining some of this fuel optionality, this flexibility will be critical. I would add that maybe also there is a lot going on the refining side. A lot of investment done to convert some existing refineries to biorefineries, but also to green the production of refineries. In my company, we have launched a huge green hydrogen tender to procure hydrogen in order to lower the carbon content of the products we sell out of the refinery. And among these products, there could be some products that could be used by the shipping industry. Oh, but of course, it will be an expensive fuel, and the first thing you need to do is really to reduce your consumption as much as possible. On the bio LNG, I think Evangelos mentioned it. It's we have a potential in some big countries in the world, in order to avoid some pollution by the feedstock industry, by the agricultural industry, and convert this potential, this waste, into biogas. And wherever you have infrastructure existing to inject this gas in a network, and this is the case, for example, in the US, then you will have the liquefaction capacity available and you can reach the energy markets, but also the LNG bunkering market. So we think here there is a potential. It will take time because, again, it's a lot of investment required in order to develop this biogas and bio LNG potential. But it's definitely there and it can be produced and available, we think, probably as a transition, but set to grow and become available as a way to decarbonize the shipping. It will compete with other fuel, with the conventional biofuels, biogas, and other sources. So again, this is why the fuel flexibility and the fuel optionality will be very important for any shipping assets that that you own and operate. And maybe I would conclude also pointing to e-fuels, because it is also, when you think about it, the synthetic production of methane would do the same, would reutilize a lot of the infrastructure that has been taken 40 years to build and make this this part of the chain more affordable because you reutilize existing infrastructure for gas liquefaction or for LNG bunkering infrastructure. So this is also an area, maybe more for not this decade, definitely, maybe during the next one, but this is an opening for the future.
Yep, it's a mid-game to long-game type of approach. We're running out of time. I've got one last question for the panelists before I wrap up. It's a kind of a relatively straightforward question, it'd be almost like I'd like you to almost fire away your first thoughts. But what is your greatest decarbonization challenge, and what is your greatest decarbonization opportunity? Jeremy, I'll start with you.
For us, the great opportunity is that, you know, we are entering in a more complex world. We are with a lot of difficult choices to be made, so it will generate some business opportunity, and we try to see it the positive manner in order to harness these changes and see it as business opportunities. And the challenges, frankly, for me is also on it's been mentioned that the fleet renewal and the shipbuilding capacity is a concern to me, and how fast can I renew and improve the global fleet?
Pace and speed. Andy?
As I mentioned earlier, I think it's getting technical alignment with regulators. I think that's both the challenge as well as the opportunity. If that can be solved, then I think we have a much better place to work from.
Great. George?
All these discussions remind me the same theme. In 2008, the going concern was that there are not enough shipyards to cope with the demand. And suddenly, for events completely outside shipping, we had a crisis for 12 years. So we are approaching to the new cycle. When we are talking that the capacity of the shipyard is not enough and so on, gentlemen, we are ready for the new start again from point zero. This is my comment.
Evangelos?
So that's a challenge.
No, I believe nobody can, Vangeli, be predicting the future, and we are all romantic. And I say, me that I'm saying that, I have ordered 88 new buildings at $7 billion cost. But I have done it. So from now on, I'm saying what will
happen. More. So that means we have invested similar amounts. So no more, we say.
Definitely. No more. No more.
No, I think that the challenge for us is that all this access investment in alternative fuels to see that in the near future, when all the deliveries will take place, we will enjoy a healthy market, and of course, together with a healthy market, a healthier environment for everybody. And I think this is a big challenge, and we are ready, and we are one of the very first ones to go for it.
Great, thank you. Captain?
I think for us, it's always about how we are pushed. Actually, that's the biggest challenge, is how we are pushed to take decisions and what is the new alternative fuels. And we are investing, and investing heavily, just like everybody here. But, of course, the technology or the engines or the infrastructure is still lagging behind. And we are almost like ahead of the industry when it comes to basically hugely investing, putting billions of dollars into new vessels. Opportunity will always come on. Of course, carrying alternative fuels or embracing new volumes for us, that is the opportunity in it. But again, I think the challenge is bigger than the opportunity, at least in these days.
Great. Thank you. Well, let me just quickly wrap this up, because this was just great to hear from this very distinguished panel. But I think a couple of things that I wrote down here that we heard today was directly, again, from some of the biggest players in this industry is, one, LNG is a fuel with a lot of life ahead of it. There are challenges there that are there, but it will remain a critical factor in shipping's energy transition. I think we heard it is a transition fuel as well as a fuel in transition. I think we've heard through the panel that everyone agrees that success is a team sport, and probably I'd go as far to say in some ways a shared responsibility. And every owner here has had a different, there are different game plans out there. There are different playbooks to manage the family of uncertainties that they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So I want to just, if you can give the panel a round of applause, and I want to thank all of you for your time, your wisdom, and your insights.